From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new film, Devil in a Blue Dress, stars Denzel Washington as Private Eye Easy Rawlins. It's based on the first in a series of Private Eye novels by Walter Mosley. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Walter Mosley reads from Devil in a Blue Dress and talks about his life and writing. Also, we have reviews of the new film and Mosley's new novel, R.L.'s Blues. Alan Arkin stars with Andy Garcia in the new film Steal Big, Steal Little. We'll feature an interview with Arkin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Abortion foes in the House of Representatives have rejected a $243 billion defense spending bill. They say an anti-abortion provision in the measure was watered down. The vote was 267 to 151. The House rejected a defense spending bill for the fiscal year that's supposed to start on Sunday. Liberal Democrats, bolstered by a last-minute veto threat from President Clinton, formed an unlikely alliance with abortion foes against the bill. One of the supporters of California Governor and presidential candidate Pete Wilson says he's dropping out of the Republican presidential contest. Massachusetts Governor William Weld says Wilson called him today to say he's leaving the race. Weld says Wilson's campaign was hurt by several factors, including the throat surgery that resulted in the loss of his voice for 3 months. Wilson has also faced financial and organizational problems. President Clinton says he respects the governor's judgment. Mr. Clinton is cheering the U.S. brokered agreement in Bosnia. The deal's provided a framework for peace talks and a possible new government. Mr. Clinton says this is progress in his most difficult foreign policy challenge, and he must work closely with Congress to continue making progress.
I believe we must continue to work together in Bosnia, and I very much appreciate the expressions of support that have come from leaders in both parties for the efforts that we have been making in recent weeks. We are now closer to a settlement because of the initiatives we've taken than at any time in the last 4 years, because of the combined impacts of the NATO airstrikes, the United States diplomatic initiative, and the changes that have occurred on the ground.
Meanwhile, President Clinton is sending Secretary of State Warren Christopher back to the Middle East next month. He hopes to build on the peace accord that was signed yesterday by Israel and the Palestinians. Christopher will try to revive stalled Mideast peace talks involving Israel and Syria and Lebanon. Some 400 senior citizens staged a rally today at the Capitol to protest the Republicans' proposed cuts in Medicare. UPI's Pi Chamberlain prepared this report.
Seniors cheering and shouting shame and wrong came to the Capitol for a rally featuring a 15-foot-tall pretend Trojan horse, supposedly the Republican Medicare program. From its belly unfurled a banner saying, "Seniors pay more, tax cuts for the rich." A dozen speakers said much the same thing, as did House Democratic leader Gephardt.
Let the word go forth from these steps of the Capitol today that the people of this country are against these cuts in Medicare and Medicaid.
Meantime, senators moved toward passage in committee of the cuts in Medicare and taxes. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has risen more than 19 points to 4,806. Trading is heavy. This is NPR News. Venezuela's finance minister is meeting today in Washington with officials at the International Monetary Fund. He's searching for a bailout loan for his country's teetering banking system. We have more from NPR's David Welna.
Years of economic mismanagement and a severe crisis in Venezuela's banking system have forced this oil-exporting nation to look for emergency loans from both the World Bank and the IMF. Finance Minister Luis Matos says he's hoping to get $1 to $1.5 billion in loans from the IMF. But Matos refuses to accept the kind of shock treatment measures typically stipulated by the IMF for such loans, recalling that the country has erupted in riots and experienced 2 attempted military coups in recent years.
If you press too much a country that has been under the pressure of a very critical situation for many years, perhaps you can have discontent and break up the social peace.
Matos says any economic reforms will only be very gradual. I'm David Vollmer in Washington.
The O.J. Simpson prosecutors are delivering their final rebuttal to the Simpson defense. Prosecutor Christopher Darden asked the jurors to set aside the, quote, misguided fire and fury of the defense and use common sense to convict Simpson of two murders. Darden also says the fact that Detective Mark Furman is a racist doesn't mean anyone can murder and then get away with it. The case could go to the jury as early as today. Senator Bob Packwood says he'd like to be remembered for the good things that he has done, not the last things. This is Packwood's last working day in the Senate. The five-term Republican's resignation officially takes effect on Sunday when he will step down in response to allegations of sexual and official misconduct. Packwood says he's contemplating a book of memoirs. He is forbidden to work as a lobbyist for at least a year, but he says he isn't ruling out a return to politics at some point in the future. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Walter Mosley's detective novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, has been adapted into a new film starring Denzel Washington. We have a review of the film, but first we have an interview with writer Walter Mosley, recorded just after the publication of Devil in a Blue Dress in 1990. This is the first novel in Mosley's popular and critically acclaimed series about E.Z. Rawlins, a black private eye from the Watts area of L.A. Devil in a Blue Dress takes place just after World War II. E.Z. is a veteran, and when we first meet him, he's just been laid off from his job at a defense plant after standing up to his boss. E.Z. is broke, so he reluctantly accepts an offer from a white gangster to track down a white woman who has a predilection for black men. The search takes E.Z. to all of the black bars he knows. It also takes him into the white world he's unfamiliar with. Out of these situations, you get Easy's observations about race in America. Here's Walter Mosley reading from Devil in a Blue Dress.
I was surprised to see a white man walk into Joppy's bar. It's not just that he was white, but he wore an off-white linen suit and shirt with a Panama straw hat and bone shoes over flashing white silk socks. His skin was smooth and pale with just a few freckles. One lick of strawberry blonde hair escaped the band of his hat. He stopped in the doorway, filling it with his large frame, and surveyed the room with pale eyes, not a color I'd ever seen in a man's eyes. When he looked at me, I felt a thrill of fear, but that went away quickly because I was used to white people by 1948. I had spent 5 years with white men and women, from Africa to Italy, through Paris and into the fatherland itself. I ate with them and slept with them, and I killed enough blue-eyed young men to know that they were just as afraid to die as I was.
Now, your novel set in 1948, which is around 4 years before you were born.
Yeah.
This is based on stories your father told you. I don't mean the story of the novel, but the setting, the period.
Yeah, the idea is when I was a little kid, maybe five, six, seven, I would be with my father and his friends, and they would tell stories which really kind of came into my heart. I mean, you know, when you're a little kid and you listen to these wild stories that people are telling, they become part of you. So it's like I was alive then, in a way.
What were most of the stories about?
Most of the stories are about survival and having a good time. I think most of the stories are about how hard life was and how enjoyable life was. You know, a story once my father told me he was in a bar with his wife and his cousin. And some guy was bothering his wife, and my father, as a young man, pulls a knife on this guy. And my cousin grabbed the knife out of his hand because she said that if she killed the guy, she could get out of trouble by morning. And she tried to stab the guy, and she stabbed my father instead in the leg.
Jeez.
That was funny. But, like, she was there, my father was there, and they were all laughing about it, and it was, like, a great time. So I thought it was wonderful.
How did she plan, by the way, to get out of trouble if she killed the guy?
There was an idea, at least that she had, that if a man attacked a black woman or had a fight with a black woman, a black man, that the judge wouldn't worry about it, just let him go in Houston. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know, but that's what they thought.
Walter Mosley recorded in 1990, after the publication of his novel Devil in a Blue Dress. A little later, we'll hear an excerpt of a more recent interview with Mosley. First, guest film critic Steve Weinberg has a review of the new film adaptation of Devil in a Blue Dress, directed by Carl Franklin.
Carl Franklin's detective thriller, Devil in a Blue Dress, is a graceful, confident piece of filmmaking. Set in the L.A. of the late 40s, it evokes the velvety look and bluesy feel of the post-war film noirs and plays off their conventions. But the detective, E.Z. Rollins, is black, and that changes everything. Played by Denzel Washington, Easy's a machinist who loses his job and can't pay his mortgage. A greasy character named Albright, Tom Sizemore, recruits him to locate a vanished white woman, Daphne Monet, who hangs out in black bars. Easy gets a lead. Daphne's tight with an old girlfriend of his. But then the friend turns up dead, and Easy, who slept with her just hours before, is suddenly up to his neck in trouble. Introducing race into the noir mix freshens an overworked genre and authenticates what are usually mere flourishes. There's real jazz on the soundtrack. T-Bone Walker, Memphis Slim, Thelonious Monk, and the crackle of real danger charges the glistening streets. Easy's assignment leads him into white neighborhoods that his survival instincts caution him to stay out of. And when white cops mess with him, there's no guarantee he'll leave the precinct alive. Devil in a Blue Dress is entertaining, but it has emotional weight. Easy's relationship to the violence around him is complex, and that comes through in the picture's tone. In his best role in years, Denzel Washington is superb. His handling of Easy's troubled encounters with white Angelinos is delicate, layered with conflicted feelings. But he also gets to try some robust, low-down comedy. His sex scene with Lisa Nicole Carson is pure burlesque. As the object of Easy's search, Jennifer Beals is tantalizingly ambiguous. The look in her enormous eyes could be sadness, or triumph, or maybe just sexual interest. The underrated actor Tom Sizemore plays slippery Albright as the stuff of nightmares. He smiles crookedly under his pencil-thin mustache and hides his filthy agenda in the excess flesh around his cheekbones. The cast is salted with memorable personalities, like Maury Chaykin and Terry Kinney as rival politicos, and Don Cheadle as Easy's pal Mouse, ferociously loyal and incorrigibly trigger-happy.
Now we got to go find that girl so we can get that money, huh?
Hell no, we don't have to go find nobody. I done changed my mind. I don't need your kind of help, Mouse.
Boy, look at you. Man, cut a damn smile in your neck. You gonna tell me you don't need my kind of help?
See, this the same shit you pulled 5 years ago when you killed old man Navashette and them. You ain't even been in my house 5 minutes and you done shot somebody already, Mouse.
Come on, Easy. Come in on this thing, man.
No.
Easy, I'm trying to do right. I mean, now. Come on, man, I can help you. Now, you know you're gonna need somebody at your back.
The source of Devil in a Blue Dress is a novel by Walter Mosley, and Carl Franklin's screenplay sticks to Mosley's plot. But Franklin vivifies Mosley's flat, awkward prose. Franklin, who also made One False Move and the gripping TV movie Laurel Avenue, understands film genres from the inside out, and he's brilliant at coaching actors. He's the most gifted of the black filmmakers to emerge in the 90s.
Steve Weinberg writes about film for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at College of the Holy Cross. He reviewed Devil in a Blue Dress, adapted from a novel by Walter Mosley. Mosley's latest E.Z. Rollins novel, Black Betty, is set in the early 60s. President Kennedy and Martin Luther King are giving E.Z. a sense of hope, but things are pretty grim at home. His wife has left him and taken his only birth child. Money's running out, and it's hard to feed his two adopted kids. To make ends meet, he's taken on a case to find a woman who's disappeared. The book opens with a recurring nightmare about the night Easy witnessed his best friend Mouse commit a murder. Mouse gets into trouble in each of Mosley's mysteries. After the novel's publication last year, Mosley joined us for an interview and a short reading from the opening of Black Betty.
I see Mouse as the hero of the world that Easy is talking about. He's a sociopath. He's very violent. He's willing to kill people, and it doesn't affect him. Easy is the hero of these books because these books are about him. But the world he lives in, Mouse is really the hero, the man who's willing to stand up and fight and not be pushed down for any reason. Not for a political motive, just because he's crazy. He's been driven crazy by the world he lives in.
Would you read the dream for us? And this is a dream of something that really happened.
Yeah, at least really happened in the book.
Right. Really happened in the book.
They were standing under a hard yellow light in the alley behind John's bar. Big Hand Bruno Ingram was large and powerful, and he had the ability to swagger even when he was standing still. He wore a brown mohair suit with no hat and no shirt. The smaller man's suit was close-fitting and silver, imported, I knew, from Italy. I stayed in the shelter of the doorway listening to their small talk, hidden. "Dodges lost it," Mouse, the smaller man, was saying. "He sounded fine. You owe me 25 cents. "Come on, Sookie," a bodiless voice said from the street. It was a man's voice, a young man. "Uh-uh, Alfred," a woman answered as clear as you could want, but I didn't hear the rest of what she said. Bruno's bass voice was rumbling, "Get out of my face." I turned again, a sense of dread so deep in my body that it felt like the oldest thing in the world. "You could kiss my big black butt." He didn't mean it. That's what I wanted to shout out, but I couldn't make a sound. Mouse pushed against the big man's chest, not to move Bruno, but to push himself far enough away so that he could get out his long .41 caliber pistol. Bruno's manly sneer turned into an 8-year-old's wonder at what he'd done wrong. The impact of the first shot knocked him 4 feet backwards, big hands thrust out in front of him like a cartoon sleepwalker. He wanted to fall, to get down on the ground out of harm's way, but Mouse just kept on shooting, throwing Bruno up against the pork butcher's back door again and again. There was a scream, and I was stumbling backwards into the doorway.
Mouse is in jail as the novel opens, and when he gets out, he's looking for revenge against the man who turned him in for this murder. He's so different from Easy Rollins. Easy Rollins just doesn't have the temperament to rough people up. He can't rough people up to get information out of them. He's not that kind of guy. But do you know men like Mouse?
Oh, yeah. I made spouts on a friend of my father's, a man who used to hijack liquor trucks and bring cases of liquor to our house when I was a kid. And he would come over and he'd say, "Well, Roy," my father, he'd say, "Roy, why don't you keep these bottles of liquor for a week and I'll come back and get them later." And so when he would come back, of course, my father would have drunk a couple of bottles. And so the guy would say, "Well, you're going to have to pay me for those bottles now." Finally, he was in a crap game in a barbershop in downtown L.A., and he murdered a guy. He killed a guy. The guy owed him a dime, and he didn't want to pay it. So he killed him. He's in jail now.
Well, did you grow up thinking, how can a guy kill somebody over a dime?
Well, actually, I understood that. You know, the whole issue, I think, about worrying about, it's not worth it to kill somebody over a dime. We wonder, well, is it worth it to kill somebody over $1 million?
Right.
You know, the issue is different. You know, if you don't have a dime, or if you come from a place where you have to fight for everything that you have, then you just fight. It's a natural reflex, because when you stop fighting, that's when you're going to lose.
So do you feel you understand why an insult can be cause enough that can incite somebody to a murder?
Well, certainly, if you're living in a neighborhood where, you know, your rep is the only thing that you have, and if people can feel that they can insult you and push you around, well, then you're going to lose everything that you have in your life. And so you have to fight for things that seem ridiculous from an external point of view, but internally they make more sense.
So when this guy insults Mouse, Easy wants to say, "Hey, he didn't mean it, back off." But Mouse just kind of plugs him. What's your reaction to an insult when it comes your way?
Well, you know, I have, like Easy has, been able to move a little away from that place where I'm willing to fight at any moment. So if somebody insults me, it doesn't matter. If I'm walking down the street and I have $10 in my pocket and somebody wants to mug me, I'll give them the $10. I'll say, "Here's the $10. It's not worth, you know, it's not even worth me fighting, even if I could beat you. It's not worth it. I might hurt my fist." But if $10 is all you have, see, I had like maybe $100 in the bank, so that $10 doesn't matter to me right now. But the life that Mouse was living and the life that Easy is very close to is a thing where you have to fight over everything. And so you stop discriminating between when you fight and when you don't fight. You just are always willing to fight. So Mouse, when he comes out of prison, there were 3 men in the bar. One of them turned him in, he thinks. So he's going to kill all 3. That's just the way he does it, because that's the way he's going to keep his reputation up.
Writer Walter Mosley is my guest. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Walter Mosley, author of the Private Eye novels Devil in a Blue Dress and Black Betty. You have an opening quote before the book begins, Ghetto Pedagogy. Can I ask you to read it and tell us where this comes from?
This is a conversation I had with my father when I was a little boy. Ghetto Pedagogy. Dad? Yes. Why do black men always kill each other? Long pause. Practicing. I kind of like that. No, I was about 8 or 9, and my father had this, and I had this conversation.
So when your father said practice, what did that mean to you?
Well, that there was a lot of anger and rage in the black community, and it was aimed at people outside of the community, which people really couldn't exercise that rage on at that time. But they still had to exercise it, and so it was on each other. But it was, in a way, getting ready for something, something that might not ever happen, but certainly it's getting ready for something.
Were you exposed to a lot of violence when you were growing up?
There was a lot of violence in the life. I don't think there's as much violence when I was a child as there is now. However, there was a lot of violence just in everyday life, just in the experience of everyday life. A lot of violence, a lot of anger, a lot of rage, a lot of despair. You know, I feel, I react more to psychological violence than physical violence. Physical violence is kind of easy to avoid or stay away from. But there's a kind of psychological violence in everyday life that black people and poor people in general experience in America.
What kind of psychological violence were you most exposed to growing up?
Well, just anger. You know, people who were angry all the time, people who were upset all the time, people who felt that other people were trying to take advantage of them. And sometimes they were right and sometimes they were wrong. Confrontations about everything, about how much something cost, about where you're going to go. I remember coming out of a restaurant with my father when I was, and my mother, when I was about, 12. And there was a valet parking, and so my father comes out and he gives the guy his ticket, and then another guy comes out after us, a white guy, and he gives the guy the ticket. And the guy goes directly to get the white guy's car and brings it back. And, you know, they get in. And my father goes up to the valet and he says, well, listen, you know, I want you to understand, in a very loud voice, I'm not going to give you a tip, and I'm not giving you a tip because you went and got that man's car before you got my car, but I was first. Now, I was, you know, 12, I was very embarrassed by this whole thing, but there, my father was angry. He needed to express that, so he needed to talk about what was happening to him. And I think that went on an awful lot when I was a child.
Do you think he was right in doing that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No question about it.
Is it hard growing up with so much anger and seeing all these slights all around you and not grow up with a personality that's obsessed with victimization?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing because even when before you get to the point of whether or not you're a victim, you have to wonder, because people become so sensitive to these slights,
mm-hmm.
that sometimes there aren't slights. One of the things that Easy experiences in the books is that sometimes he's expecting a slight and it doesn't happen. And sometimes when he least suspects it, it does happen. And sometimes it's not from white people, it's from black people. It's very hard to figure out where you stand in the world. And you know, it's hard not to feel you're a victim, especially when you are in certain ways. But then you have to begin to understand that we're all victims and that your job is to live your life and to survive, not to, you know, to worry about what somebody next to you has or doesn't have or what they're thinking.
Now, your father grew up in the South, and, you know, you're writing crime novels. There is violence in your books. Did your father tell you stories about the violence he was exposed to growing up in the segregated South?
One day, you know, it's hard to talk about the segregated South because it, even though that really is a definition of what went on with my father, it's broader than that in experience. One day my father sat me down and explained to me, or he told me, every person he'd ever seen die. It was just amazing. Little children killing each other, black children, black people killing white people killing black people killing, you know, everybody killing each other, people being hung, people dying because there was not a proper protection on their jobs. And then he went to World War II. And he talked about all the people that he saw die in World War II because he worked in statistics, so he typed up the names of everybody, all the Americans who had died. And finally, he came back to the South after that, and he found that all of his old friends, or most of his old friends who didn't go to war, had died also in, you know, these kind of petty and stupid little fights and arguments and from disease in the South. And so he moved to Los Angeles. And when my father, this took a long time to tell me all of these deaths. And at the end of it, he said, so then, Walter, I came to L.A., and I knew I was finally free. I was in a land where these kind of things weren't going to happen anymore. And he sits down in a diner, and the guy next to him has a heart attack, keels over and falls on my father's lap.
Oh, no.
And dies. And it was a good way to end it, because it was a funny story. But also the idea of, you know, there's segregation, there's violence because of racism and from ignorance and poverty, but also we all die. And I think that's what he was trying to tell me.
Yeah, your mother is white and Jewish. Your father was black. I know some white people who have married black people have been in the absurd situation of finding that their families have disowned them for marrying a black person.
And black people, too.
And black people disown their person for marrying a white. Did anything like that happen on either side of the family?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It did to some degree. And it was very funny. The matriarch of my father's side of the family liked my mother, so she could never be completely ostracized. So she got along with her, invite her over, and would do things. And some of the family didn't like her, and that kind of wore off after a while, and they got along. And on my mother's side of the family, my grandfather just didn't understand. Even though he was a doctor, he didn't really think that black people and white people were the same, like, species. Not only not the same race, but the same species. But a very funny thing happened. He came to visit once to see his grandson, because, you know, my mother demanded it and came out. And he was kind of taciturn. And he went away. And then my father built a house in the backyard, built a whole house. He floored it, walled it, plumbed it, wired it, did everything. And my grandfather came back and he saw this house. And then he saw that my father had built it. And so in a funny way, my father kind of proved that he was better than my grandfather, because my grandfather would love to do something like that and couldn't. And so then after that, my grandfather really liked him. It was a very kind of country thing, you know, because my grandfather was from he was from a rural background too. So my father in some way proved to him that he wasn't inferior. It was funny. Then they got along great after that.
So, but on the whole, did both families get along?
Oh, yeah, they got along great. When I was 13, I had a big party. I couldn't have a bar mitzvah, so I had a big party. And we invited both sides of the family over, you know, my Aunt Fanny and my Uncle Chaim and my godfather, Hollister P. Fontenot, and the Douglas family. And Hollister, who was 6'5", and the jokester on my father's side of the family, and Chaim, who was only 4'9", and the jokester on the other side, would stand in a corner telling each other jokes. It was wonderful.
That sounds great.
Yeah. By the way, all this conflict I was unaware of. Nobody in the family ever said it to me.
So how'd you find out?
Oh, when I was 30 or 35, I was talking to my mother about it, and she told me.
Walter Mosley recorded last year after the publication of his novel, Black Betty. His first E.Z. Rollins novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, has been adapted into a new film. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the new Walter Mosley novel. Critic Milo Miles reviews R.L.'s Dream. This one's not an E.Z. Rollins mystery, it's a blues novel. Also, an interview with Alan Arkin. He stars with Andy Garcia in the new film Steal Big, Steal Little. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Author Walter Mosley seems to own the fall of 1995. The movie version of his novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, opened today, and he has a new novel called R.L.'s Dream. It's a break from his mystery novels featuring detective E.Z. Rawlins. Critic Milo Miles considers how well Mosley makes the transition from unsolved homicide to a work of what Mosley calls blues moments.
It's a shock to pick up a Walter Mosley book without the reassuring voice of E.Z. Rawlins anywhere around. Rawlins provides an addictive blend of soothing surface and turbulent depths, and I worried that Mosley might turn out to be like Raymond Chandler, who got lost and pretty boring without the voice of Philip Marlowe to guide him. But once it becomes clear that R.L.'s Dream is not a mystery book as such, the voice of country blues musician Soup Spoon Wise blots out all yearning for E.Z. Rawlins. Soup Spoon is in the twilight of his years, down and out in New York, and racked with cancer in his hip and lungs. After his landlord evicts him, he's saved from utter destitution and quick death by Kiki Waters, a scrawny white redhead girl from the South who takes him in. She runs an insurance scam with the company she works for to arrange treatment for Soup Spoon's illness. Just as he feels well enough to begin playing music again and getting his past in order, both Kiki's scheme and the fragile life with Soup Spoon begin to unravel. Mosley has said that R.L.'s Dream is a blues novel in the sense of the blues as a state of mind, a condition of life, not just a music or even an occupation. The book is also tied up with one of the grand themes in African-American art, life in the Deep South and the black diaspora to different parts of the country. Many of the most vivid passages in R.L.'s Dream concern Soup Spoon's memories of childhood in the Delta region of Mississippi. In one dream, he sees this. The wind through the stiff yellow grass wheezed like an old woman. Hidden in there were all kinds of birds that were named for their colors and sizes and personalities. They sang and warbled and croaked. Crows came from the devil, but they couldn't catch him. They called his name in crow words, but the little boy just laughed. Both Soup Spoon and Kiki are wounded creatures. Soup Spoon says of the drunken Kiki, a victim of an abusive stepfather, all she knew how to do was hack and scratch. Their support for each other gives them a kind of reckless strength that Mosley outlines in Fire. He describes how the blues longs for a home that is nowhere, for a peace that is the cessation of pain. And yet it's a tremendous moment of triumph when Soup Spoon regains the will to play music again after decades of forgetting it. This is the blues that destroys hardship and revives the blood. R.L.'s Dream is troubled at times. Mosley has to finesse the problem of how Soup Spoon can be a truly potent blues player and yet be totally obscure. He never made any records and bitterly turned his back on music when country blues went out of fashion with black audiences in the 40s and 50s. I guess that's possible. A knottier problem is the looming, uneasy presence of R.L., which is Soup Spoon's nickname for none other than Robert Johnson, the celebrated devil-ridden master of country blues who died young in 1939. Soup Spoon supposedly met Johnson, played music with him briefly, and recognizes it as the high point of his life, a brush with blues greatness. Why, Soup Spoon's former wife is sure he married her only because she had slept with Johnson once. You worry about Robert Johnson and his legacy. He's such a public ghost, romanticized and sanitized over and over again from movies, magazine articles, and a postage stamp. Johnson himself proclaimed he would have a rambling spirit even after death, but it's probably time for all of us to give him a rest. That said, Mosley does the finest job of resurrecting Johnson as both a wily human being and a talisman of the vanished southland of country blues. There's a sort of eerie tingle every time he enters the narrative of R.L.'s Dream. All doubts fall away because with Soup Spoon and Kiki and even Johnson, Walter Mosley hits notes, as he puts it, so good you close your eyes so you can just listen to them in the dark.
Milo Miles reviews world music and roots music for Fresh Air. His criticism has been published in the New York Times and the Village Voice. He reviewed Walter Mosley's new novel, R.L.'s Dream.
Thank you.
Coming up, an interview with Alan Arkin. This is Fresh Air. Alan Arkin is starring with Andy Garcia in the new film Steal Big, Steal Little. Arkin will be honored October 9th at the Mill Valley Film Festival in California. We have a 1989 interview with Arkin. His earlier films include The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming, Wait Until Dark, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, Catch-22, The 7% Solution, The In-Laws, and Joshua Then and Now. As a director, he did the stage and screen versions of Jules Pfeiffer's Little Murders. His new film, Steal Big, Steal Little, is a Cain and Abel story with Andy Garcia playing both the good and the bad brother. They're twins. Reuben, the good twin, is trying to keep his greedy brother Robbie from stealing his Santa Barbara ranch. Arkin's character, Lou, arrives just in time to give Reuben some advice. Reuben believes history proves he's bound to lose the ranch.
There they are, Lou. Spanish Armada anchored in the harbor, ready to steal the land from the Indians. It's all happened before. The Spanish took it from the Chumash, the gringos from the Mexicans, my brother from me. I'm gonna lose it all.
No, you're not. You don't lose anything until I tell you you lost it.
You know something I don't know?
Yeah, I do. Don't trust your friends, because when they screw you, it'll break your heart.
Can't trust a friend, who can you trust?
A neutral party. Me. I'll bail you out, but you gotta make me a partner.
You wanna be my partner?
Yeah.
I'd be honored.
In 1989, Alan Arkin told me that before he became an actor, he used to mimic the people he knew.
I used to imitate people on the street. I used to imitate actors that I saw. I used to imitate family members. I used to watch people's behavior in terms of how affected I was from an acting standpoint. So real life became fodder for acting for me, which I think helped my acting, but didn't do my life any good particularly.
So even Thanksgiving dinner was, you'd be there watching how everybody was behaving?
Yeah, how did this person eat? Why am I moved when somebody says something in that way? And why can somebody else say almost the same thing and I'm not moved by them? It doesn't affect me. I was really caught up in that from a very early age on, from the age of 6, 7, 8.
When you were growing up, was there anyone in your family or in your neighborhood who was theatrical in the way they lived their life? I don't mean that they were necessarily on the stage, but they had this sense of the theater of life.
Yeah, oh, very much so. There was a guy named Sam Kennedy, who was the husband of my mother's best friend, who was the most flamboyant character I'd ever met. He was right out of Sean O'Casey. And he wore black turtleneck sweaters, woolen ones, without any underwear underneath, and jeans in days when nobody was doing things like that, in the 40s and late 30s. And he was about 6'4" and had a mustache and was a merchant seaman and a sculptor and a guitarist and drank like a fish. And he was the most flamboyant person I think I'd ever met. And
you like that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But it was very organic. There was nothing artificial about it. It came right from the heart of him.
And any really colorful speakers?
Speakers?
Mm-hmm.
Well, him, my father was always very good verbally, and my grandfather was made speeches for the Masons, so he was very literate. I have a vivid memory of him reading a speech, tears streaming down his face, to a plumber who was, the two of them were in the bathroom, and the plumber, all you could see was his feet sticking out from under the bathtub. He was paying absolutely no attention to my grandfather. And there he was reading this passionate speech with tears streaming down his face.
So here you were with all of this interest in theater. And when you got, I think it was when you got out of college in around 1956, you were part of the pop folk group, the Terriers.
Yeah.
And they had a hit that made it onto the charts, actually, of the Banana Boat song and what, Cindy O' Cindy.
Yeah.
It almost seems like you were miscast in that group.
Oh yes. I felt so myself. I ended up after about 2 years being on stage at the Olympia Theater in Paris to an audience of about 3,000. We were singing Hearts on it, and I looked down at myself, and there I was in black satin pants and a sport shirt open to my navel practically. And I said, "Who am I? What am I doing here?" And I quit that night and went back to what I wanted to do, which was be connected with film and theater.
How did you get into the detour of folk music to begin with?
Well, I had gotten out of college, and I had gotten married and had a small child at the age of 22, and I needed something to do to just get us going. And there was this group that started, and I thought it would only take up my weekends periodically, and we'd make a little spare change to just survive on it. And within 3 months, we had an enormous hit on our hands, and so we traveled around the world with that for about 2 years, and it just seemed to me that it was the logical thing to do at the time. And I also thought, in my naive fashion, that would be an entree into film and theater, which it wasn't.
Alan Arkin is my guest. Let's talk a little bit about your first feature film, The Russians Are Coming. Earlier you said that when you looked back on this role, you didn't feel like you saw yourself, you saw the character.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play a short clip from the movie, and this is a scene from early on after the Russians have landed in New England, and you've knocked on the door of a family. Carl Reiner's the husband, Eva Marie Saint is the wife, and you're taking them at gunpoint into their home and hoping that they'll help you find a boat.
All the keeping calm, please. Yes. I repeat, no harm is coming. All now, please, being seated.
It's all right, honey. Just take it easy now, Pete boy. Don't be scared. There's no need to be scared.
I'm not scared.
Good. Good boy. Now, to answer some few questions very quickly, please, so that there is no necessity whatsoever.
Whatsoever.
So that there is no necessity whatsoever why everybody in such a nice American family should get shot to little pieces. You understand? Yes. Good. Now, what else people are in this house?
So that's your first feature role.
Right.
What stage were you in acting then? How did you prepare for that role?
How did I prepare? It was mostly in learning how to speak Russian and thinking a lot about what I wanted to do. I didn't do any research because I didn't know how I could do any research. I wanted to be very comfortable. It was important to be comfortable. It was my first feature, and I knew I was going to be panic-stricken because it's something I'd wanted to do for 25 years, and it was just too big a hunk of my life to relax about.
So you actually studied Russian for the part?
Yeah, for months. I studied Russian with an old woman in New York. Nobody had told me what to do or how to do it. I was left to my own devices, so I worked for months with this woman trying to get the sound. And I was pretty good at languages, but there were sounds in Russian I could not hear. And then finally, after several months, I began to hear the sounds and I got the lines down in Russian. I went on the set and I said my first line in rehearsals proudly. And there were a lot of real Russians on the set. Nobody understood a word I was saying. And it turned out I was speaking a Russian that no one had spoken for about 50 years. It was totally archaic, and I had to, on the set, start over again from the very beginning, which was very unnerving.
So how much of the Russian do you remember?
I can still say my lines. You can wake me up in the middle of the night, and I can do my lines verbatim, and I can't do it with any other film.
But can you talk to a Russian?
I can say my lines to him from the film.
I'm sure that's a real help.
Yeah.
Alan Arkin, let's jump ahead to 1985, to your role in the movie Joshua Then and Now. And you starred along with James Woods in this movie. You played James Woods' father, a small-time Jewish gangster and bootlegger. And I want to play an excerpt from a flashback scene in which you're in a gym with your young son and you're teaching him about the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
What do we got here? Quote, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me," unquote. Yeah, you see, there was a lot of contenders in those days. Other gods, mainly no account idols, bums of the month, until our God, Jehovah, came in and took the title outright. He made a covenant with our people.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, where was I? Yeah, thou shalt not commit adultery. That's, thou shalt not steal.
Thou shalt not steal?
Yeah, right. Well, you know, there's Ten Commandments. It's like an exam, right? I figure you get 8 out of 10 right, you're pretty much at the top of the class, aren't you?
Was there anyone you knew in life that you could pattern this character
on? Not a soul. No, nobody I knew. I loved that character. The minute I read the script, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with him. And that was it. I told Ted Kotcheff, the director, who was wonderful to work with, I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, fine, go ahead, that sounds good, and that's what I did. I worked out a lot. I got myself in pretty good shape for it, in scenes they never ended up using. So I got into good shape for nothing. For nothing.
What a waste of time.
Yeah, it was terrible.
I have read about you that in the late 60s or early 70s that you started yoga and also found someone who was something of a guru figure for you.
Mm-hmm.
What brought about that change?
What brought about the change was 7 years of analysis in which I worked very hard and which I feel like I really needed. I was very unhappy. And I came to a point where I was coming to the end of my analysis by both my doctor's recognition and my own, and feeling like I'd passed the course, and having him say akin to, I never promised you a rose garden. And I found myself getting furious at that idea, because I saw that there were people that had rose gardens, and I wanted one. And if analysis wasn't going to do it for me, particularly since I had worked very, very hard at it, and had accomplished a lot of what my doctor felt was to be accomplished from it, I felt like I had to look elsewhere. And I started working with somebody who turned out, who I knew immediately was the best person I had ever met. He was the wisest and kindest person I'd ever met. And initially, I didn't know he was a yogi. He was my stand-in on a film, on Poppy. And
he was playing an extra, so he was playing a stand-in.
He was my stand-in, which is not a terribly exalted job, mm-hmm. as everybody knows. And after about 3.5 weeks, I could sense very clearly that he was the center of the entire film. It's not as if he was loud or pushy or taking over anything, but he just radiated something that people gravitated towards. Like one person would be telling him their problems, another person would be asking him for a massage. And I got really quietly enraged by that. And it was, again, nothing that he was attempting to do. He wasn't attempting to run the show in any way. It was very quiet. And if you didn't really look for this, you wouldn't have even noticed it. And it annoyed me. So I said, here I am. I have everything. I'm the star. I got 10 times as much money as he's got. I got more attention. And he's the center of this thing. It's not right. So I tried to find out who and what he was, and he finally revealed the fact that he was a guru. Has got a terribly convoluted connotations this day. We've twisted around and almost destroyed the meaning of that word. Everybody who knows something is now called a guru, which is not what the word means by any stretch of the imagination. It means slayer of darkness, which is ultimately what analysis tries to do and doesn't do. It knocks off a piece of it, but it doesn't get the whole thing. And a great spiritual teacher knocks off your darkness, which is the thing that is keeping you from functioning fully and wholly and completely and lovingly.
Can I relate this back to acting and ask you if it's changed the way you act or changed how much you act or the kinds of roles you take?
Yeah, to a degree. It depends on how much money I've got in the bank, in part. I mean,
sure.
If I'm feeling pretty flush, then I feel more comfortable in turning down things that I don't want to do. But if I'm behind a payment on the house, then I got to be a little bit more generous in my assessment of something. But yeah, I don't want to play horrible people anymore. I don't want to. It's no fun. There was a time when I had so little sense of myself that getting out of my skin and being anybody else was a sigh of relief. But I kind of like myself now a lot of the times, and I don't see any real necessity or value in playing people that I find abhorrent anymore. That's number one. And number two, I like to think if I possibly can be in situations like it, I want my work to be connected with things that somehow serve people in some way.
Would you like to be working as much as possible or as little as possible?
I love working when it's with people that I'm excited about working with, and it's when it's with projects that are have some redeeming feature about them. Otherwise, I'm just as happy to stay home and write or do nothing. I don't feel a burning need that I've got to act anymore or direct.
What do you do when you're doing nothing?
I'm thinking about writing when I'm doing nothing.
That's what a lot of writers do, is think about writing.
Right.
Well, Alan Arkin, I thank you so much for talking.
Thank you.
With us.
You're wonderful to talk to.
Oh, thanks. I really enjoyed this very much.
Alan Arkin stars in the new film Steal Big, Steal Little. He will be the honoree at the Mill Valley Film Festival in California, which begins October 5th. This Sunday on the Showtime cable network, he's featured in the first of the six-part series Picture Windows. His installment is called Soir Bleu. Our interview was recorded in 1989. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. This is Fresh Air. When our commentator Dagoberto Gilb was a teenager, he used to go to demolition derbies. Now he goes to the neighborhood bullfights. A recent visit to the ring prompted these thoughts.
The last time I went to a bullfight, I took my oldest son Tony around the back to show him an event few see. Three donkeys, yoked, harnessed, have dragged a dead bull from the dirt basin of the arena and up a tunnel and to the door of a nearby building that resembles a garage. A chain is cinched under the front legs of the bull, and a motorized hoist lifts him. His eyes are empty by now, though his body, especially his teeth and legs, still seems alive, even dangerous. Just 15 minutes earlier, in the ring, his tongue looked as white as his horns, but is now scarlet with blood as it droops from the side of his mouth. He's being put upright to be heaved onto the bed of a pickup truck, which is backed up to the door. I had a camera with me that I assumed, wrongly, was loaded with film. I'd already snapped off some powerful shots, in my amateur opinion, when a young boy, maybe only a year older than my son, standing on the pickup bed, directed a sharp knife between the bull's legs. When he was done, he held the big black sack in his other hand and looked at me. Aquí, señor. Here, mister. He raised the bull's cojones high and smiled like they were a shiny trophy. I clicked. That unprinted photo was of my son Tony becoming a vegetarian. And he hated vegetables, too. I used to make jokes about his conversion. He was a donut-tarian, a churro-tarian. But he hasn't eaten a burger since that day. Bullfights have never been a conscious interest of mine, either as art or sport. They're just something to do, something different, very different. Something in the neighborhood I go to at the last minute. Juarez's Plaza Monumental is only a 10-minute drive from my home. I go as a spectator, not a participant. I'm not critical or supportive, only curious. I noticed the ad for this weekend's bullfight the day before. Obviously, I didn't even have to ask Tony, but this time my younger boy, Ricardo, had mysteriously decided he wouldn't go either. He just turned 13, the same age Tony was that last time. Why not, I asked. Tired, he said. Not in the mood, he said. The fact is, he loves meat too much, and he was afraid what happened to his brother might happen to him. I really think you should go, I told him. It'd save a lot on food money if you became a vegetarian, too. He wasn't sure I was joking. So when I went without my sons this time, while a group of men in aqua shirts rushed the arena to rake away the broad, almost rutted trail the killed bull leaves in the dirt as he's dragged away, I followed him, again, to the back. It was the same scene. Same thick chain, same hoist, and a pickup truck. The bull had those same eyes that, motionless as they were, I swore could still see. As always, I felt his power hovering there, even if nothing moved. Felt he was looking back, listening. This time, two boys, I imagined them as brothers, and I think they were, watched near me. First, the older boy touched the coarse, matted black hair of the bull's enormous torso. Then the young one would. Older brother, then younger, touched the head, an ear, a horn, a tooth. They both knew that this was an animal. They both knew he was dead. They were gentle and respectful, but not afraid. The pickup began to move out. The younger boy had been standing eye level to the bull's face as it slumped on the bed of the truck. While the bull stared straight at him, he waved goodbye as only a little kid can.
Writer Dagoberto Gilb lives in El Paso, Texas. He's the author of The Last Known Residents of Mickey Acuna and The Magic of Blood. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Roberta Shurrock, with Nancy Updike, Kathy Wolf, and Alan Tu, who also directed today's show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. Let's go out with Lou Reed's version of Kurt Weill's September Song.
When I was a young man courting the girls, I played me a waiting game. If a maid refused me with tossing curls, oh, I'd let that old earth take a couple of whirls while I plied her with tears in place of pearls. And as time came around, she came my way. As time came around, she came.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of Writing Home by Alan Bennett, author of The Madness of King George. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.